Hello and welcome to Warships Pod. And joining us for this episode is Dr. Robert Farley. He is a senior lecturer teaching security and diplomacy courses at the Patterson School of the University of Kentucky in the United States. Thanks for agreeing to come on the podcast, Rob. And I wonder if, to begin with, you could just explain a little bit about what you do in your job, and then we can maybe chat about a few things that are relevant.
Yeah, well, so first I want to say it's an honor to be here, and I'm delighted to be able to interact with the audience for this pod. So what I do in my day job, I'm, as you say, a senior lecturer at the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky. I teach security classes. I write on security affairs, naval power, air power, space power, even to an extent. I teach a class called Defense Statecraft. I teach another class called Wargaming. As you would imagine, both of those are pretty exciting over the past couple months. And lately, one of my biggest jobs has been informing people in the Commonwealth, as we call it here in Kentucky, in the Commonwealth about what's going on with Russia and Ukraine.
And yeah, when it comes to the Ukraine war, has it been much of a bombshell in your circles? I mean, you said that it's been very interesting recently. So before talking about the naval side of it specifically, has it had much of an impact? Has it shaped your working day, would you say, over the past month or so?
Well, certainly it's shaped my working day. Essentially, every media organization in Kentucky wants to know what's going on, and the university here has a commitment to supporting the local community. And so my day has involved a lot of TV, radio, and other things, basically trying to explain to the Kentucky audience what's going on in Ukraine, and then how what's going on in Ukraine matters for people here in the Bluegrass. And it does matter. And it's not obvious in some ways, but it does matter. For the broader academic community, I was just at a conference last week called the International Studies Association Conference. And the Ukraine war was the number one contemporary topic of discussion. And so it's definitely impacted essentially every part of my day.
So it's not viewed in the United States as a remote European war that doesn't affect America. I mean, it is automatically in people's consciousness, would you say? Or is it people like yourself that have to put it there?
No, I mean, it seems to be people are asking me about it. People are saying, well, your day must have gotten exciting because this happened. It's still something that appears every night on even the local news, much less the national news. And so, it has remained very much in the American consciousness, as the war has sort of plowed on into its fifth and sixth weeks.
And how would you say, from your point of view, has the West in general, I mean, the West is a term that went out of fashion for a while, but seems to be back now. And how would you say the West has in general coped with, on the one hand, the diplomatic side of it, and on the other hand, supporting the Ukrainians militarily?
Well, on the diplomatic side, I find it almost astounding the degree to which there has been unity in the West about Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Now, certainly there are a few outliers, but very few of them in Europe, very few of them in North America. Japan has been fully in support of sanctions on Russia and opposition to Russia, condemnation of Russia. So diplomatically, in terms of, and as you say, the capital W West, which somehow, you know, for some reason includes Japan, but the capital W West, I think there has been an almost stunning degree of unity on this question of what to do with Ukraine. I think that especially Germany stepping up has been quite remarkable, and Germany really promising to transform its security policy in response to this. So on the diplomatic side, there is at least in the West, I think there's this stunning degree of unity. Sort of outside the West, I think we've been less successful. India is a major outlier here, but even in Latin America and Africa, it's been difficult to gain a degree of agreement over condemning Russia. But I think there's some progress on that, especially with the latest revelations about Russian atrocities in Ukraine. And I can only imagine that we're going to see more of those or more evidence of that in the future as Ukraine retakes parts of the Russian-controlled territory. In terms of military policy, I was just reading a report now about the Czech Republic sending T-72 tanks to Ukraine. This has already been happening. I think that NATO and the United States have really poured weapons into Ukraine. I think the questions coming up are, what are we going to see in terms of major offensive systems like main battle tanks, like fighter aircraft, like potentially anti-ship missiles, larger long-range surface-to-air missile systems, and so forth. And there seems to be an openness in the West about transferring those systems. We know Ukraine wants them. We know Ukraine has the expertise to use them in a lot of cases, even if they need training. And so again, it's been quite remarkable to me the willingness of the United States and NATO to step up and support Ukraine's war effort.
Yeah, and one of the main things that people in general have been asking about and pressing for is a no-fly zone. And I've seen no-fly zones being launched in the Arabian Gulf from HMS Invincible, which was a Royal Navy aircraft carrier sending Sea Harriers over Iraq in connection with and supporting American carrier packages. And I've also seen sanctions being enforced at sea in the Adriatic and also in the Gulf, and also, in fact, a no-fly zone over the Balkans, and was on board HMS Ark Royal as they recovered a pilot who'd been in a Harrier that was shot down. And from my point of view, no-fly zone idea was something that would, A, take us towards potential direct clash with Russia, because I don't think people understand in many ways what a no-fly zone involves. And I don't think it was perhaps the right solution to what the Ukrainians need. So what's your opinion on the no-fly zone idea?
Well, so I'm going to use a word here that I only really know through vocabulary, but I think is probably more common for your audience, which is daft. The entire idea seems daft to me. It would involve the United States and other NATO countries becoming immediately engaged in combat with Russia, right? Which would be air-to-air combat, but would also be air-to-ground combat, because there are Russian surface-to-air missile systems all over Ukraine. Almost any no-fly zone has to engage those systems. And so there would be attacks, air-to-ground attacks from NATO aircraft into sort of Russian positions in Ukraine. But the Russians also have surface-to-air missile systems that are based in Russia that cover parts of Ukraine. And to avoid being shot down by those systems, you would have to engage not only the surface-to-air missile systems that are in Russia, but also aircraft in Russia that have air-to-air missiles that can reach deep into Ukraine. And so I have not seen a formulation of the no-fly zone that to me makes any sense at all. I mean, it seems to me that you would be playing to Russia's strengths, and you would be accepting an unnecessary level of escalation. So it seems to me like an idea that a lot more stuff would have to happen to make it make sense.
Yeah, and I think the thing that a lot of people overlook and maybe don't know in the first place is that the Iraqi Air Force didn't exist shortly after Desert Storm began in 1991, and a lot of it flew to Iran, took refuge in, and a lot of it was shot down, and it still wasn't there when the no-fly zone was being imposed over southern Iraq and northern Iraq. And also the same goes for the Serbian Air Force in the Balkans. That was did not contest the Allied, shall we say, the Western no-fly zone over there. And of course, Libya's Air Force was similarly non-existent. And as you mentioned, the ground-to-air missile systems, of course, the same goes for the ground-to-air missile systems. And the Russians are a whole level above that. I mean, they are top tier when it comes to that sort of thing. And also, as you also pointed out, the missiles are launched from within Russia, and that includes cruise missiles targeting things in Ukraine, and a lot of the bombardment has come from ships in the Black Sea too. And looking at the naval side, that's something that hasn't really come to the fore very much. There's been a fair amount of activity, but is that anything that you've had to explain to anybody, or anything you think has thrown up anything that's remarkable that we could look at?
Well, I mean, I think that just staying on the theme of the no-fly zone for a second here, you know, if we were to be serious about enforcing a no-fly zone in ways that would be safe for NATO aircraft, it would almost necessarily have to involve attacks on Russian ships in the Black Sea, right? Because those Russian ships in the Black Sea have air defense systems. And so they're also going to be threatening sort of deep into Ukraine. A no-fly zone, I think, also almost immediately becomes a naval war. You know, with respect to the naval war thus far, I think that the Russians have, they are conducting what we regard as a long blockade, a long range blockade of Ukrainian ports. The Ukrainian Navy was largely lost in the 2014, and almost literally lost. I mean, the Russians just took it. When they took the main naval base in 2014. And so the Russians aren't exactly looking at a situation where their ships are being threatened by Ukrainian vessels. I think the sort of the big interesting question has been, were the amphibious assets that the Russians almost painstakingly transferred from the Baltic? And this is sort of Russo-Japanese war type stuff where these Russian ships have to leave one port and then weeks later they arrive at another Russian port, which has been the Russian naval dilemma, for the entire history of Russia. And these Pucha-class amphibs that arrived in the Black Sea, were those ships going to do anything? And at this point, the war may go on for a while, but at this point, it kind of looks like no, that the only places where they could launch a plausible amphibious assault seem to be very well defended, and would be almost suicidal for the Russians to attempt an amphibious attack. And we've seen the pictures in Odessa of what the dockyards look like, and I think the Ukrainians are just sitting there, come on, bring it, waiting for the Russians to show up. And we've also seen some degree of Ukrainian success in sinking an alligator class amphibious, although I think the Russians said it was an accident. But anyway, that's even worse than getting sunk by the Ukrainians, is having one of your ships just randomly blow up at dock. And so, you know, I think the Russians have utilized their sea power advantage here to blockade Ukraine on the one hand, and at least early in the war to offer a plausible threat that probably tied some Ukrainian forces down in Odessa. But now I think all we have is the blockade, and I'm not sure that the Russians, besides launching a few more ship-launched cruise missiles, are going to be able to have much impact from the sea on the war. I'm curious your thoughts on that, though.
Yeah, I mean, I was watching the assembly of the landing ships, as you mentioned, from the Northern Fleet and the Baltic Fleet, and they're making their progress out there. And then not long after they went through, along with a submarine as well, cruise missile and submarine, the Turkish government, once the hostilities started, closed the straits, the Turkish straits. And so that kind of sealed them in there and stopped those Russian warships that had gone into the Eastern Mediterranean to operate from Tartus in Syria and to keep an eye on the NATO navies there. And so they're now divorced, and that gives a huge problem to the Russians in that they cannot now take the vessels from the Black Sea fleet back into the Black Sea. And somehow, if they want to change them over, they can use Tartus, but at some stage they will have to turn over missiles, which will then see that whole thing you referred to, like the Russo-Japanese war of them taking vessels from the Arctic right the way round to the Eastern Mediterranean and changing them over and all the rest of it. And of course, the use of the amphibious vessels in the Black Sea has either been a classic Maskarovka distraction, while the Russians hoped, I think, in their fantasies that they would drive along the coast of the Black Sea and take everything in their path from the Sea of Azov through Mariupol, through Mykolaiv, and then to Odessa, and then that would be Ukraine sealed in. But they clearly, thanks to the Ukrainian military, have not been able to do that, and so now they've been left with these landing ships which are not suited to any kind of D-Day assault. I mean, if you think of D-Day, it was thousands of ships. This is like 12, 15. I mean, as you say, they would get wiped out. And they're landing ships that have no over-the-horizon projection capability, apart from the modern one that came from the Baltic. And that's only a couple of helicopters. So they're ill-suited to any kind of amphibious assault. And as you say, the Ukrainians would absolutely destroy them. So I think there's huge problems there for Russia in enacting its dream of taking Odessa. And there is talk now, of course, of anti-shipping missiles being sent. But I should imagine that it would take time to train people to use those. And that's one of the things, the other aspects of this war that maybe you've got some thoughts on, is the whole idea that we could just give the Ukrainians weaponry. I don't think Ukrainians think like this. I think they know what they can and cannot use. And I don't think you could just give, Abrams tanks or Challengers or modern fighter aircraft to the Ukrainians. So it has to be something that they can use and will be most effective in actually dealing with the threat they've got. So, I mean, what do you think to the whole future of the support militarily, short of, any kind of boots on the ground.
So I want to step back and talk just a little bit about a contingent moment in history, which I'm sure you recall. Back in 2014, it very much looked like the Russians were going to be able to acquire two modern amphibious warfare vessels from France. Right, the French were building these two Mistrals that eventually end up in Egypt. If you can imagine those Mistrals there in the Black Sea right now, that's a complete game changer. These are two large modern warships that have that have aerial capability and have significant amphibious capability. And if these were in the Russian arsenal right now, then I think we're having a completely different conversation about what the situation in the Black Sea looks like. But that's, of course, why everybody sort of laid down on the French and said, "You cannot do this. You cannot sell these two large modern ships."
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, on all of these things, right? All of these weapons, right? So the first thing I think that people have sensibly approached this is when you're talking about sort of big modern offensive weapons, start with things that the Ukrainians can use, right? So the Czechs sending T-72s, and I think other countries are going to send T-72s, which the Ukrainians know how to use. The fighter jets is a little bit more complicated. The MiG-29 issue has been done to death, but the long and short of it is that the Polish MiG-29s are not like the Ukrainian MiG-29s. They have been upgraded in different ways, and these are both two different complete trees of upgrades. And if you've ever talked to a fighter pilot, the differences in the way that the weapons are used and the way the cockpit is shaped, that stuff takes time to learn. I've seen a pretty good argument that, especially given how long this war may last, we should just pick a fighter and start training Ukrainian pilots on it, right? You know, whether we decide it's going to be the F-16, or the Typhoon or the Gripen or something else, just pick a fighter, start inducting Ukrainian pilots and start training them in Germany and Poland. And then 3 months down the line, you start having a plausible air force and you can backfill, with, frogfoots and, fulcrums and so forth if you need to in the time being. And that idea seems sensible to me. The anti-ship missiles, again, this is one where, people who know how these things work approach it much differently than people who just, you put some harpoons, put them on the coast, and they'll fire them off and something will happen. And the answer is, of course, something will happen, right? Because you'll shoot these things off and then no one knows where the missile's going to go, right? Yeah, I mean, you're going to send it out there. It'll find something to kill, right? Not necessarily something Russian.
It could be a merchant ship or something like that right. You really don't want to sink.
Right. And so, Ukraine has to have a significant surveillance capability, targeting capability. People have to be trained on these kinds of things. And all that takes a lot of time. Now, again, we may have time. The Russians seem to be sort of laying in for a significant war here. And if we're thinking 5 or 6 months, then we can plausibly think about sort of genuinely lethal weapons that can be transferred to the Ukrainians. And to be honest, I don't mind that at all. Like, I don't mind the Ukrainians getting more lethal weapons, because I think Russia's behavior here has been just appalling. And so we should help the Ukrainians however we can.
Yeah, and it has been terrible and something I don't think we'd ever dreamed that we would see in our lifetimes happening, really. Certainly not in Europe or anywhere else. This scale of war, this sort of invasion and, brutality, really, that's being unfolded in Ukraine. And above and beyond all that is, of course, the nuclear threat. And the Russians came up with a new doctrine, which we've publicized or rather written about in the magazine a couple of times. And that enables them to basically use, in their minds, nuclear weapons against anybody they dislike, like somebody who sneezes next door or, wears a color of clothing that they don't like in the Czech Republic or in Poland, and they retain the right to be so offended that they could use their nukes. I mean, that's a ridiculous way of putting it, maybe. But they have brought the level of the threshold down so far with their nuclear weaponry that it now includes cyber attacks or conventional attacks or anything happening that they deem to be an existential threat to the state. So when people talk about the no-fly zone and then talk about, but somebody's got to take on the Russians sooner or later, the thing that looms over it all is, of course, the nuclear threat. So Is that something that in any discussions you've had over there in the USA that you've encountered a sort of awareness that nuclear war is a possibility or is something that looms there and that really once you start getting on that escalator, then humanity's had it or a large chunk of it? Is that something that's been in people's minds? Are they worried about it, do you think?
You know, the first two questions that people ask me around here are, how does this matter for the bluegrass? How does this matter for Kentucky? And the second question is, are we all going to die in World War III? And, you know, if we all die in World War III, obviously that matters for the bluegrass. But, you know, the nuclear weapons question in particular, you know, I've told people is sort of almost exactly what you said. Like the way that Russia thinks about nuclear weapons means that there is a non-zero chance that we could see a Russian nuclear weapon being used. I wouldn't say it's high, but it's not zero. And, you know, we have to approach that realistically, right? Because on the one hand, just because Russia has nukes does not mean that they get everything that they want, right? It's not a Christmas list for Putin that he can just credit. Nukes are not a credit card that he can buy whatever he wants with. But at the same time, we have to be careful and cognizant, and we have to be thinking ahead. Okay, well, how do we limit the chances that Russia might use a nuke? And then if Russia does use a nuke, how do we limit the chances that there might be escalation after that? And that, I think, has produced a lot of, you know, pretty sophisticated conversations here, at least among some chattering classes in the United States, about how to deal with this threat. Because I think it's a genuine threat. You know, I would probably say we're still at less than 2% or 1% that a nuke will be used in Ukraine, but a 2% chance is bad, right? I'm curious what kind of concerns are there in the UK about that.
I don't think the nuclear issue is actually thought about too much in a kind of rational way in the UK. I think there's on the one hand you have in Parliament and in the political classes a very very tiny percentage of people who let's say are in the on the left, the far left of the Labour Party or wherever, who are totally anti-nuclear. And of course, the Scottish government in Edinburgh is against nuclear weapons, wants them off Scotland's soil if country of birth goes independent. And so there's that. But then there's a kind of almost an unquestioning attitude towards them on the other side, where there's not really what I would call an adult and mature debate on it. There's the sort of we must have nuclear weapons and we must have the deterrent. Fine, okay. But what does that mean? You know, does that mean you'll use them? How many? And it's like, I think it was Theresa May was asked, would she be perfectly willing to kill, was it thousands of Russians or something like that? And this was play on Putin's mind when if he ever watches the House of Commons having one of its Barneys, you know, Prime Minister's Question Time. And she goes, I would be prepared to kill tens of thousands. And I wonder if even people like that really think about what nuclear weapons use means and how it would escalate and how serious it would be and how devastating it would be. I mean, this is a relatively small island with a lot of people on it and, you know, you wouldn't need that many nukes to wipe it out. So I think it's a terrifying and terrible prospect. So I think there's a lack of mature debate on one hand and then the kind of unreasoned, we can't have them at all debate. And I say unreasoned because I think that nobody knows how the mind of Vladimir Putin works. He's either rational or he's insane or he's going to do this or he isn't going to do that. So I think you have to be careful. I think you have to take a balanced approach to it. I mean, nobody wants nuclear weapons. Nobody wants a nuclear war. But I think in the UK, I generally think there's not a lot of serious thinking about it. And certainly when some people saw the Russians invade Ukraine and Putin was making his threats in his palatial surroundings to use nukes, a lot of people were suddenly, some people I knew were suddenly very worried that it would suddenly happen today or tomorrow. But I was a bit like you. I was saying, well, it's not a 0%. It could happen. But, you know, get on with your life, you know, just focus on your normal life and get on with it. So I know that's a bit of a circuitous answer to what you said. But, you know, I mean, I think you and I, we are fairly rational about it and we think about it because it's part of our job. But I think to sum it up, I think the majority of British people just never think about it. And of course, the big thing now, and this comes maybe to the next thing we could talk about, is the UK's energy policy is a complete mess. So although we're not reliant on Russia for gas, have, I think, about 6% reliance on it. There's renewables of the future. What do we do in the short term? Do we have hydrocarbons? And also, let's have lots of nuclear power stations, says the Prime Minister, you know, as if you could just whistle them up. So that's another aspect of the nuclear debate. But of course, the whole, coming back to what you do, I mean, the whole idea of security and diplomacy and the rest of it, and the supply of gas from Russia to Europe. And also, I think when it comes to the war at sea, the blockade at sea in the Black Sea, the question of the wheat, you know, and I don't know how serious that is. But I mean, are we in serious trouble, not only on the energy side, let's say in Europe, but also is the world, do you think, on the brink of a kind of lack of wheat and a bread shortage and people going starving around the globe? Have you had any thoughts on that? Have you looked into that at all?
You know, on the energy question, I'm still struck by the fact that the Russians expected to win this war so quickly that they decided to invade in late winter, where they thought that they could maximize their influence over Europe, and didn't even occur to them that the war might last a month or 2 months, where the weather is getting warmer and Germany needs gas less, right? So, you know, their leverage over Europe wanes as the war gets farther on. And, you know, the Germans have until November to really sort through how they're going to deal with the problem. You can't build a nuclear power plant before November, but you can certainly come up with other ways. And so this, again, is, I think, one of these aspects where the Russians just did not think very seriously about what they were doing before they did it. You know, the wheat, I'm not a specialist in food supply chains, but Ukraine is a huge wheat provider. I mean, that's what the Ukrainian flag is. It's what Ukraine, does on the, and it's been a critical part of the Ukrainian economy and Ukraine's contribution to the world for the last 200 years. And so, you know, Britain fought an entire naval operation to open up the opportunity for Ukrainian wheat exports in World War I.
Tried to, yeah,
we'll do their best, right? And so, you know, this is a situation that the world is it's less immediate than the energy situation because there are stockpiles, but we're looking at later this year a situation where you might see actually really significant growing food prices that's going to cause a lot of discontent around the world. And honestly, I'll be straightforward here. I think there are a lot of countries that are sitting on the fence right now, not really wanting to condemn Russia, that are going to have to be more serious about this because they're going to have riots. And who are they going to blame those riots on, right? Hopefully not the Ukrainians, because the Ukrainians would love to ship wheat out of their ports and the Russians are stopping it. But, you know, I mean, we're looking at a late fall and a winter where we might see significant increasing food prices around the world. And that could have a lot of follow-up effects.
Yeah, according to Die Welt, it's an article I've looked at. If I just got it on the screen here, it says that up to 300 ships have been stopped by Russian forces from departing the Black Sea, leaving the grain exports, the route virtually blocked. And that's what it said just a short while ago. So I suppose, as you say, it's a looming problem. Do you think it could be, on the other hand, that the Russians did factor in these sort of things? Do they think in that, on that scale, do you think? Are they that? I mean, I know they are organized on some levels and disorganized on other levels, because I've seen it myself during trips to Russia a long time ago. But I mean, would they have thought about that? Is Putin like that? Did he think, well, we'll go to war? I mean, I'm just putting out there another scenario. Did he actually think, well, we'll go to war at the moment while it's not so critical for Germany, you know, to have this the gas supply, so they won't be quite so hard on us? And then, yeah, we can blame it on the Ukrainians for maintaining the war until the autumn, when things get a bit squeaky, or when the winter comes on and they need their heat. And the same goes for the grain. Do you think the Russians, who until recently, certainly post 2014 and the annexation of Crimea, were seen as geniuses at hybrid warfare? I mean, have we found out that they are not geniuses at hybrid warfare, or could this whole energy supply and grain thing be part of their long game to kind of tighten up the pressure as the war drags on?
My first answer is we just don't know, right? And we don't know, we may never know, right? There may be a time in the future where we have access to archives and we have access to conversations that Putin has had and high-level strategic discussions. What we are already seeing is that the Russians are attempting to reframe what is really, to my view, a catastrophic defeat on the approaches to Kiev as something they had planned the entire time, right? That this was just a feint to distract the Ukrainians, and the fact that, you know, we had however many BTGs annihilated by the Ukrainians was all something we had planned from the start, which is frankly absurd, right? But pro-Russian mouthpieces are eating that up, right? I mean, they want a reason to believe that Russia is omnipotent and powerful, and the Russians are offering this account to them. I don't think the Russians wanted a long war here. And I don't think a long war benefits them. I mean, they've already suffered atrocious casualties. Ukraine is militarily growing stronger as Russia grows weaker. And so, you know, we have a saying here in the United States, which is 11th dimensional chess, right? Which is this idea that somebody is playing such a long game that you don't really even understand what game they're playing. And I think that accounts that suggest that Putin still had all of this planned out, they could be true, but they also smack of 11th dimensional chess. And I think we're attributing too much genius to Putin, and I don't think this has gone according to Russian plans.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at some of the people on Twitter, a guy called Rob Lee, who puts up the open information on the casualties they've had of the funerals and everything, nothing that isn't already out there, but he gathers it all together, and it's brilliant the way that he does a lot of those things. But the one thing that, you know, I've looked at and is quite something to marvel at and quite appalling and also sad but also fascinating is the amount of top commanders, not just the generals but also the majors, the colonels, the young platoon commanders and company commanders in the VDV, the airborne forces, and also the naval infantry, who people may or may not be aware have been drawn from the far north. In Murmansk, there's been at least one naval infantry formation from there, from Siberia, from the Pacific, and also, of course, from the Crimea. And they've been hurled into the fighting wherever it is. And so the punishment that the elite forces, the supposedly elite forces of the Russian airborne forces, and also the naval infantry, and, of course, the Spetsnaz, as well, have taken, that cannot be good. And you have to say, these are guys that, if you look at their record, fought in or waged war in Syria, in Chechnya, and so they've gone. So it's very difficult to replace people like that. And where do you get them from? It's all gone. And maybe that is a sign of how crazy the whole thing is and how crazy Putin was, in that these are some of the people that he gave medals to, and he, you know, they were years in the making, these guys, and now they're all gone. So it's a bit like the Japanese Navy in the Second World War and its carrier aviators, who were magnificent as far as Japan was concerned during the attack on Pearl Harbor, but thanks to Midway and also the Marianas Turkey shoot and other things, were wiped out. And once those pilots were gone, you just had kids left. So I think the Russians are in that situation now, and Ukraine has been the graveyard of some of their top people and their top military formations. So it's just been an absolute I was going to use a rude word there, but it's been an absolute muck-up, shall we say. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But one thing I would be very interested in getting your opinion on, because it's beginning to exert itself in the news here, not majorly, because, you know, it's not a current-day news story, but it's the 40th anniversary of the Falklands War. And a bit like the Falklands, the fact that that Russia was going to do something in Ukraine was fairly well signposted, probably not as much during the Falklands 40 years ago as the Ukrainian thing. But certainly people knew, let's not forget, this was before 24-hour rolling news in 1982, and also before Twitter and all these things and online news. So it was signposted that the Argentinians would invade the Falklands. Negotiations came to nothing. The intelligence sources in South America and Latin America said that the Argentinians would probably invade. And then when they did, Britain was was caught with its pants down, really, and some Royal Marines put up a very stout defence as much as they could in the Falklands themselves and also some other islands called South Georgia. The Argentinians took possession of the Falkland Islands. And there's been some reference, I think, by Argentinian diplomats to the war, saying, you know, at least one diplomat or non-diplomat, shall we say, saying that the Ukraine versus Russia situation is the same, and basically depicting the Argentinians as the Ukrainians, whereas if you're in Britain, you'd see it the other way around, that the Argentinians had invaded sovereign British territory and taken it over. So the Falklands War is an example, I think, of signposting. Something's going to happen, and it did, being caught on the hop and then trying to recover from that and fighting back. So is the Falklands War anything that has ever made any impact in America, in your circles? Or is it something you think does offer parallels here, or any lessons for the future?
I mean, I think that the contrasts are very interesting. I mean, with respect to your question, does anybody in the United States remember the Falklands War? The straightforward answer is no. Right. I think even people who were alive during the Falklands War barely remember the Falklands War. Certainly elite level foreign policy people and so forth do have this recollection. But even then, I mean, the Falklands War is what? It is as 40 years ago. So almost nobody who was any level of, I would say that, right? The president of the United States was almost 80 years old, right? And so he's had an opinion on everything that's happened since World War II. But that's unusual, right? So, I mean, I think one of the interesting contrasts is that there is just so much more information available now, open source information about what is about to happen in international affairs, that you know, even to the extent that the invasion of the Falklands wasn't exactly a surprise if you were paying any kind of attention, that even in 1982, you could achieve levels of tactical and operational surprise that you simply can't these days, that are just impossible. And I know, you know, people with respect to Ukraine managed to be surprised by the invasion after the Russians had put a gigantic army on Ukraine's borders and repeatedly said, we're about to invade. And the United States said, they're about to invade. And people still managed to find themselves surprised by that. But that's not an intelligence failure. That's just a failure of someone's intelligence. You know, it is interesting that, and I think that taking a look at what Ukraine means for Taiwan, right, which certainly has some parallels with the Falkland situation. One of the things to come away with is that, you know, if the Chinese are invading Taiwan, we're going to know about it, right? We're going to know about it possibly months in advance, but certainly weeks in advance, because you cannot keep secret the movement of troops and of formations this size anymore, right? If nothing else, the soldiers themselves will not stop recording TikToks about where they are, and they'll not stop tweeting or whatever else about where they are and what they're doing. And so you're going to know that the conflict is going to happen. And so this idea that we can achieve strategic or operational surprise, even to the extent that it was possible in 1982, is just not something we're going to see in the future, right? Not under the current technological situation that we have with respect to being able to, you know, make the world transparent.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. It is astonishing that you and I on different sides of the Atlantic can sit there with our iPads and of an evening and have the news on in the background with that aspect of it. And then we can scroll through Twitter or wherever else and look at videos that, you know, have been shot by drones and other information. And it's all there. And for me, as a former news reporter and somebody who worked in newsrooms in the old days when print led, to see stuff on Twitter that even television cannot keep up with, that you then see the same footage you've seen on Twitter two or three days earlier. Of course, they have to verify. I understand all that. But a lot of people on Twitter now are pretty good at verifying things. And then they are behind all that. So it moves at such pace now that you're right. I don't think anybody will be able to keep it secret if China was about to have a go at Taiwan. And the Chinese are building, they do have the world's biggest navy now. They are building similar ships to those ships that France tried to build or was going to build for Russia, but which, as you said, ended up in the Egyptian navy. And so China will have several of those ships. It will have capabilities to do it. But, you know, would it try it in the face of all that scrutiny? Would it succeed? Or does it get caught up in this idea that it is the now the coming superpower and it really has to make itself that global naval, you know, behemoth that it wants to be, and economic and all the rest of it. So maybe it will happen, maybe it won't. But of course, the similarity, I suppose, between China and Russia, if the only audience that matters is your own audience, and I think a Russian diplomat said this yesterday, it might have been Lavrov, that actually all that matters is what the Russians think, then they can wall off, the Chinese already wall off their people from the outside world and that contrary information. So maybe they will try it, and they'll just try and keep it quiet if they can from their own people. But one thing that was prominent, certainly in British waters before the Ukraine war and as it unfolded, was the NATO naval presence, which leapt up. And one of the things that I noticed was a lot more US Navy warships were coming to UK ports, Plymouth and Portland and elsewhere around the UK. And that is something that we hadn't really seen for a long time. It started rising again after Russia had annexed Ukraine. I suppose that was the changing moment. And of course, there are four US Navy destroyers based in Spain at Rota that have ballistic missile defense capabilities, and we see those around. But when you look at the open information on the US Navy presence in European waters, the Baltic, off Norway, elsewhere, the Mediterranean, it's been absolutely staggering how many destroyers are around and how much it's actually grown. And you mentioned Taiwan there. Of course, the US Navy is supposed to be pivoting, as is the US military in general, towards China, towards dealing with the Chinese threat. So here we have the Russian threat suddenly rises up. The Chinese threat is rising. So when it comes to the US Navy, a colossus of the oceans, the only effective colossus of the oceans, the Chinese Navy may be bigger, but you know, it doesn't hold a candle at the moment to the US Navy in terms of capability and we hope efficiency. So where do you think the US Navy is with all this, coping with global multiple things that it has to bear in mind for US and international security?
The European commitment is interesting, and the balance of US naval forces between Europe and Asia is interesting to me, because, you know, Russia is in a predicament militarily and financially, and is going to continue being in a predicament. And the statistic that I'm fond of quoting to my students who are worried about Russia or worried about China is that in every single year between 2000 and now, the Chinese have launched more major warships than the Russians have launched since 1991. It's hard to say that that changes at any time in the future, right? And so the Russians are still having sort of main fleet units that are Cold War era, not just Cold War era designs, Cold War era ships. Now the U.S. has a lot of those too, but we also have a lot of newer ones. And the only area in which the Russians are still sort of usefully competitive is in submarines, and that's not irrelevant. But you know, if you're thinking about how the West and how NATO is going to distribute its naval power, it really does kind of seem like the French and the British can manage the European situation and the Italians. You know, I think a lot of people are talking about the Navy right now, and you know, we have to reckon with the fact that two of the major three acquisition programs that the U.S. Navy has embarked on over the past 15 years are just catastrophic failures. And that's the Zumwalt class destroyer, which has produced essentially three demonstration ships that may never have any kind of real serious military utility, and the littoral combat ship, of which we are now attempting to retire nine of, some of which are 18 months into their service, because we have judged them to be largely useless for conflict at any level, you know. Even the third one, which is sort of vaguely more successful, is still troubled, which is the Ford-class aircraft carrier. And, you know, they'll sort the Ford-class problems out because they have to. And, you know, if you throw enough money at it, eventually you're going to be able to solve the electromagnetic problems and so forth. But, you know, we're still committed to building these Arleigh Burke destroyers on a 1980s, it's a great 1980s design, right? It's a 1980s design that was adopted by the Koreans and the Japanese and so forth. It's a great design, but it's still 40 years old. And you know, we're getting a new frigate that should hopefully correct some of the mistakes of the LCS program. But, you know, at a time when the first significant competitor to the U.S. Navy since really 1944 has emerged, it's not a great look for the United States Navy to have failed as dramatically as it has failed in terms of shipbuilding and procurement over the last two decades. And I think Congress is deeply irritated about it. The Navy is certainly, confused about what happened. And if the question is like, how much of your advantage can you fritter away over the course of two decades and still be able to maintain a powerful fleet? And I think, you know, if there's a parallel here, it's to look back at the sort of the Jackie Fisher era, or the Royal Navy shortly before Jackie Fisher, in which there were emerging competitors around the world. And it really took this storm going through the Admiralty to prepare the Royal Navy for the war that was going to come. And it's unclear that you feel like there's a sense this has to happen in the United States, but there's a question about whether it's actually happening.
Yeah, I suppose it needs leadership, it needs political leadership, decision-making, prompt decision-making, and also the right kind of, as you say, revolution. And I suppose a lot of people would put their money on, back in Fisher's day, he put his money on submarines and super dreadnoughts and, you know, oil fuel for the Queen Elizabeth class and other things. But today, I suppose it would be drones, which seem to be getting their baptism of fire in Ukraine. I mean, if we talk about the naval side of it, then they're an immature technology, although people are pushing ahead with various drones and making them bigger and more efficient in terms of endurance at sea, etc. But I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, I see in the UK, we do take an age to get on with warship procurement, and we don't build very many, and then we cut programs down to not very many, so they end up costing more per ship. And then when we turn out a destroyer, it turns out that it doesn't work very well in the heat, and it's got power power problems, and it's got hardly any, well, I wouldn't say it's got hardly any weapons, but I know because I spoke to some of the senior officers at the time. They had to make compromises with the Type 45 destroyer, and they couldn't have crews, and they couldn't have this, and they couldn't have that, because they had to have the anti-air missile system. So we now have, you know, an era when you've got to have firepower and presence and force levels and critical mass to deal with it. You've got to have at least something to deal with it. And as you say, France, Italy, and the UK should be able to deal with the Russian threat. But, you know, I think they've got years and years of work to do, and a lot to catch up on. I don't feel any sense of urgency yet, although we do have a uniformed head of the UK Armed Forces who's an admiral. I don't know what will happen. Are we going to see more Type 26 anti-submarine frigates? Are we going to ever see more submarines than just the 7 Astute class? Are they going to accelerate things? We don't know. I mean, we've got a major problem with the Royal Fleet Auxiliary. It has declined, and it shrunk as the aircraft carriers have come into service, so that when we did a global deployment with HMS Queen Elizabeth, there was one dry storage ship, and that had a fire shortly before the task group left the UK. And if that had been a really serious one, it would have had no dry storage ship. And so there's big problems in the Royal Navy that need sorting out. And I will look forward to seeing some urgency from our politicians about doing it. But it was interesting that you mentioned Jackie Fisher and the battleships, because, of course, you and I have both written books to do with battleships. And you've written for Warships IFR in a number of ways, for the magazine itself, for the Guide to the US Navy on Modern Naval Affairs, but also on battleships. So a fun thing for us to do, I guess, is to look at a little bit at battleships and their amazing lives, and just kind of nominate favourite ones. I know it seems like a bit like a Top Trumps thing, a spotter thing to do, but what in your view, as somebody who's a bit of a connoisseur of battleships, what would you see as the finest battleship that ever sailed in that long ago era?
My goodness. Well, so I'm not going to offer the finest battleship, but I will offer sort of the most interesting and maybe one of the most important classes of battleship. And this was the Congo class battleships, which is a class of 4, initially classed as battle cruisers, later rebuilt rebuilt and reclassified as battleships. And these ships are fascinating to me because of the interesting history that was associated with them. As you know, the first ship, Congo, was constructed in the United Kingdom. There was a massive technology transfer. The Japanese had already been building battleships, but this one was a really important ship, and they really wanted to make sure they got it right. And so there was a massive technology transfer. I also study technology transfer and intellectual property and so forth. And just the construction of the Congo was really interesting in context of how much knowledge the British transferred to the Japanese to enable them to build the other three ships in the class. The result in 1913 was, you know, they turn out this ship, and the Congo is the most powerful battle cruiser in the world when it enters service, right? That it's considerably more advanced than the battle cruisers. It's even more advanced than the Tiger, which follows up on Congo. You know, it's very fortunate for the Japanese that it was completed before the war started, because I'm sure the British just would have seized it.
They would have, yeah, definitely.
Right. And it would have been the most powerful battle cruiser in the Royal Navy, had they appropriated it. 14-inch guns, high speed. And what's interesting about these ships is that people think about battleships, and people especially think of battle cruisers as ships that were obsolete almost as soon as they left, because they were vulnerable. But the Congos, not only do they serve in World War I, not really in a combat capacity, but in reconstructed versions, they're some of the most useful Japanese ships in World War II, right? These ships that Congo herself was built in 1913, right? And she is still a frontline unit and an incredibly important and useful warship in 1944, where she serves at Leyte Gulf. Her sisters serve in battles of Guadalcanal. And it's because they have an enormously powerful armament. They have high speed. They have great range, right? Just a whole set of characteristics that that make them incredibly useful ships, and ships that are consequential in ways that other ships that are built later, say the R-class battleships in the Royal Navy or all of the standard battleships in the U.S. Navy, sort of are never able to approach the Congos in terms of their basic utility as naval units. And that's a really interesting phenomenon for that I like to think about, because it goes to this question of how do you predict whether this investment in a particular kind of naval power is going to pay off in the long run, right? Because this is one where the Japanese, you know, accidentally or no, they picked exactly the right characteristics for a ship that was going to be a dominant, important vessel 30 years later. And, you know, did they just guess right, or did they have a sense of what they needed? That was just a really good procurement process. And of course, the ships themselves are just beautiful, right? I mean, all Japanese ships with the giant pagoda masts and so forth have a certain gorgeousness to them. So right now, Congo is a ship that I think about a lot in terms of its, you know, its procurement, its construction, its immediate impact, and sort of its ability to make an enduring contribution to Japanese naval power.
And I think you're going to write about the Congo for us in the mag.
Yeah, that's the plan.
And I would look at a ship that was built about the same time. That would be Warspite, which I've written about a fair bit. And revolutionary, the oil fuel for the propulsion, for the speed, heavy hitting, well armoured, maybe not as cutting edge as the Congo, but certainly lasted as long, if not longer, than the Congo. You know, went from World War One straight from the off into action at Jutland, straight through the interwar years into World War Two, and garnered in the end more battle honours than any other Royal Navy warship in the Mediterranean at Matapan, and also at Narvik, earlier than that, at Narvik in the fjords. So Warspite was an absolute legend and revolutionary, quite a gamble. Winston Churchill was had sleepless nights because he thought he'd gambled his entire career on it and the future of Britain and the empire. So a particular favourite. And it's interesting what you said about, I think with the British, it's more accidental in some ways than it is a design, because they suddenly realise they need something and they'll rebuild Warspite just before World War II. Or in the case of HMS Rodney, a battleship with a sister vessel Nelson built in the late 1920s and commissioned then, that in the case of Rodney, actually only proved her worth, I think, 16 years into a career when finally, despite a dodgy rudder and propulsion that had a tendency to be hard to run and not give the speed that was necessary, came face to face with the Bismarck and did the close-in destruction of that brand new German battleship. So 16 years, and that's something that... when I heard a lot of the criticism of today's Royal Navy carriers when they were being built, it reminded me of the things that were said about Rodney and Nelson when they were being built in the late 1920s, when, of course, Britain was almost a pacifist nation and it was on its uppers economically. And it was, why are you building these battleships? You can't even get the guns right for them. What's the point in them? And there were all sorts of meetings between politicians and shipbuilders about this, where this was thrashed out, and public meetings where people got angry at people suggesting that these were useless white elephants. But it took 16 years for Rodney to actually deliver on the investment that had been put into her. So I think that any warship is the same, as you suggested with the Congo as well, that somehow in certain instances you come up with a vessel that finally delivers, but you won't know until the moment comes that I think I might need that warship, or, you know, you'll be lucky enough to have it in that particular place to do something quite amazing. So yeah, no, that would be the one I would pick, would be Warspite. But I, you know, it's hard to choose between Warspite and HMS Rodney for me, but there you go. So looking to the future of navies and global naval affairs and security and diplomacy, I mean, are we, do you think, now moving into a new Cold War, a new more dangerous era that's actually even more dangerous than the Cold War? Where do you think we're heading? It's not a cheery note to perhaps end on, but, you know, where do you think we're going?
I think we're definitely moving towards something that resembles a new Cold War. I mean, I think sort of in the United States, the comparison that people have made is an economic one, right? And some sort of far-sighted strategists have brought this up. And they've made the point that the United States has not faced an economic competitor of the significance of China since Kaiserin Germany. And even with respect to Kaiserin Germany, the U.S. growth rates were vastly ahead of German growth rates. And so the United States economy was going to stay ahead of the German economy for the foreseeable future. And this is the case since 1870, right? The United States has had the world's largest economy since 1870. And, you know, whether that's ending now or 10 years from now or 5 years from now or something along those lines, it's not going to be the case forever. And so China is a fundamentally different kind of threat than the Soviet Union was, or than Japan was, or even Nazi Germany, in terms of its ability to bring economic heft in a way that Americans are simply not prepared to conceive of, right? That we've never had the strategic class, the strategic culture to think about. And so that's something that's really quite new for us. And so I think it, in that sense, it's more dangerous. In another sense, you know, I don't know. I mean, the Chinese seem to me to be altogether more reasonable than the Russians. I don't know if that persists forever, though. And so I think we can foresee a lot of danger in the future.
So would you say that one of the things that we might see is, in a way, a reversal of the Cold War, the old Cold War, in that back then there was worry about China in the West? But it was really Russia that was the main threat and the most powerful threat. China didn't really have the military threat. It wasn't capable of global power projection. And so that wasn't something to worry about. And do you think that's the way it'll be in the next few decades? We'll have China as the sort of main lead player, the big guy, and then Russia has spent itself in Ukraine and is now kind of a hollowed out menace for Europe may need to worry about?
I mean, I think that the sort of the biggest question for this new Cold War is going to be which side can hold its coalition together. You know, the Chinese and Russians have tried this being allies thing before, and it didn't work out. You know, they almost fought a war with each other rather than fighting the United States. But on the other hand, I think everybody's surprised by how well the coalition, the NATO coalition, has held together. The Quad, which is how Americans are thinking about managing China in the Pacific, it's held together less well. You know, Australia and Japan and the United States are all fully on board, but India very much is not. And so I think that sort of for this new Cold War, this how do we manage, how does each side manage its coalition is going to be the big question, right? Can the Chinese, you know, either put their foot on Russia's neck and say, look, you're our friend, whether you want us want to be or not for the long term. Can they detach India from the Quad? Right. These are the kinds of questions that I think are going to dominate our diplomacy and security policy in the future.
Fascinating. Fascinating stuff. Well, I think we could conclude on that. Just a look to the future and some great thoughts and analysis from you during the podcast episode, and that's a good way to pay off. So thanks very much, Rob, for coming on, and it's been a brilliant chat.
Ah, no, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Warships IFR podcast. The new edition of Warships IFR magazine is out on April the 22nd, and we have the usual mix of news, commentaries, analysis on global navies and their happenings related to them. Plus also quite a bit on the war in Ukraine, developments such as mines being found in the Black Sea, whether or not the no-fly zone I touched on in this podcast with Rob is a goer, whether or not it flies, and also other things such as defence spending increases in response to the new Russian threat and the prospect of a new Cold War. The latest Odin's Eye in the May edition is on the peace dividend and how it's now dead as a dodo, and that Europe must now up its game in terms of boosting defences. And we also have an interesting look at a new kind of conventional deterrent that may or may not restrain Vlad the Invader. If you'd like to obtain the magazine itself, please visit your local newsagent and pick one up from the shelf. Or, if you like, ask them if they can order it in. Alternatively, visit the Warships IFR website, warshipsifr.com, and you can obtain it that way. You can subscribe to get a hard copy each month direct to you wherever you are in the world, or get a digital edition. You can connect with us via Warships IFR on Facebook. That's at Warships IFR. Very easy to remember. Follow us on Twitter on at Warships IFR, or check out our amazing videos of warships themselves on YouTube, which is called Warships IFR TV. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time.